This is another episode of the Decoding Purpose podcast. My name is Rebecca Tapp, and in every episode of Decoding Purpose, we speak to humans of both influence and impact to explore how life's turning points help us to decode purpose and to ignite a more meaningful and purpose-driven life. Welcome to another episode of the Decoding Purpose podcast. Now, if you're a regular listener of the podcast, you might have noticed that over the last few weeks, we have been releasing a lot more episodes. And the intention for that, especially with our Friday episode, was to give you the right information to help you to be able to navigate the pandemic in a purposeful way. However, this week we will be peeling back just a little bit and going back to our original format of releasing one episode per week. So every Tuesday you will get a brand new episode of Decoding Purpose. And if you haven't already hit subscribe at iTunes, please make sure you do so you don't miss an episode. And also just a reminder to follow along at the Decoding Purpose podcast Instagram account, which is at Decoding Purpose podcast. You'll be sure that you won't miss an episode there. We'll be posting all of our updates. Now, as for today's episode, another goodie. We are all aware that we're standing on the precipice of change right now. But knowing what that change will look like tomorrow, next week, next month, or even next year is completely unknown. None of us really know what to expect. The thing is, in accepting that we don't know, we somehow counterintuitively put ourselves in a purposeful position where we are empowered because we're able to make a choice about what it could look like. We are able to play, touch, feel, or imagine the possibilities. Ultimately, it's a time to get curious about a brave new world. And that is why today I'm excited to get curious about all things curiosity with one of the coolest and most curious cats I know. And yes, that was all a little bit of a tongue twister. This is a person I have worked with, and today I'm so grateful to also call her a friend. Her name is Dr. Kate Raines Goldie. Kate is a speaker, consultant, and a passionate creator of curious environments. She's also the host of the New Future podcast, which is a brand new podcast exploring what could and should be our new future in a post-pandemic environment. Kate is a speaker, designer, innovation columnist, researcher, and a passionate creator of games. She's a producer of XRWA, Australia's largest immersive reality conference series, which ran for the first time in 2019. And she's also a certified facilitator of LEGO Serious Play. Did you even know that that existed? And I have to say, I have done it. And it was not only playful, but I also gained some incredible insights into my professional life. So I'd highly recommend that. Anyway, let's get on with the episode. Welcome to the Decoding Purpose podcast, Dr. Kate Raines Goldie. Welcome to the Decoding Purpose podcast, Dr. Kate Raines Goldie. Such a pleasure to have you here.
Such a pleasure to be here.
Well, look, I want to kick off with a question that I ask every guest on the podcast, and it's one that I am curious to ask you. Over the course of your life, have you lived your purpose because you made an intentional decision to do so? You made a choice? Or do you think that fate or destiny played a role in who you are and where you're at in your life today?
Well, that's a great question. And I think it's somewhere in between, because I think that I didn't actually realize I was living my purpose until I realized what my purpose was, which is more of a recent thing. So I was doing it without realizing that I was doing it. And maybe I made some kind of choice before coming to this version of myself on this planet. But now I'm intentionally living it. So yeah, somewhere in between.
Most people answer that question with the same kind of framing around it. And I've come to calling it intentional destiny.
I like that.
Now, Kay, as you know, this podcast is all about decoding purpose. However, your area of expertise is actually in decoding curiosity. With that in mind, if you reflect on your own life, how have you used your curiosity in order to discover your purpose in life?
Well, I think actually curiosity is part of my purpose, is being curious and helping other people to be curious and helping them to really, I think, thrive and be okay with uncertainty and use curiosity as a tool. So it's kind of like being an evangelist for curiosity. So I would say it's kind of fulfills itself.
I love that. And look, I think a big part of choosing a purposeful life is doing so with curiosity, almost as your guiding light, enabling you to lean into lots of possibilities until you land on something that really does resonate, where you're able to access that feeling of meaningful connection in your life.
Indeed, I agree with that.
So for you, I know that early on your curiosity for a future yet to exist manifested itself at the University of Toronto, where you began presenting and publishing groundbreaking research into social networks and internet friendships long before social networks were even a thing. And I imagine that would have been, without giving your age away, maybe 2 decades ago.
yeah, something like that.
I'll leave a question mark around that. But
it was in my early 20s.
Yeah, to give some time context. So, Kate, in studying social networks, what did you learn about the purpose of why and how people connect?
Oh, that's a really good question. And I think that's actually really timely given all of what's been happening right now with COVID-19, because it's almost like we've all had to, or use the internet in the way that it was kind of originally or early imagining of how we were going to use the internet for connecting with each other. And I think that really speaks to the importance of connection. Like that's such a human, important human thing to do. And right now, you know, where many of us are stuck, depending on where you are and what country you're in, varying degrees of rules about how much you can actually go outside or physically connect with people. The internet has kind of become this way of doing that. And I think our desire for that has really actually pushed the way that we're using the internet now to connect with people in a way that we couldn't before. And so the purpose of connection, I think that's just part of being human, which is why I think a lot of people are really struggling and really almost innovating in the way that we connect. So I think it's interesting because if you think back to, I mean, it's what, maybe a month ago, the old world before all of this happened. If we think about a lot of the discussions around social media, we had been very, you know, there was research finding that the way that we use social media, the way that we've kind of, the latest incarnation of the internet has turned into a space that actually makes people depressed and it's not good for our mental health. And the original imagining of the internet, there's a long history before it, but kind of in the 90s when it started shifting from being for academics and being for originally it was for use by, in case there was a war in the States, they could still communicate with each other. So shifting to being sort of used by the public, there was a lot of rhetoric around how it was going to save humanity and overcome race and gender and inequality and was going to connect everybody together. And then we kind of got, I think, lost along the way in terms of what actually happened. And now it's really interesting to see we're actually kind of going back to using the internet for that purpose of connecting and having that real human connection, which is it's really nice to see.
It is nice to see. And I actually have a few other questions really digging in to the possibilities for the use of virtual and digital worlds on the backdrop of COVID-19. So I'll lean into that a little bit more in a moment. Before doing that, in this season of the podcast, I am exploring the theme of turning points, and I certainly chose a pivotal year to do that. And the reason for that is because I have found that a sense of purpose is often born in these kind of moments of no return, or these sliding door moments in our lives. Now, I know for you, one of those moments was moving to Australia to study at the Curtin University, which is based in WA. Now, that in itself was a leap of faith, but it was also one that led you to complete a PhD on Facebook and privacy that today is on Curtin University's top 10 most downloaded list since it was published in 2012. So I have two questions for you. Firstly, let's dive into this turning point in your life. What about this point in time in your life was significant in becoming who you are today? I mean, moving to another country is quite a massive leap of faith to take as a young person.
Yes, it certainly is, given I'd never actually ever been to Australia before. So I guess it kind of helped that my parents are from New Zealand, so it was not entirely an unknown thing. It's somewhat unknown. At least I'd been to the side of the planet before. But yeah, it was definitely, I think it was kind of also a response to, I had started my first ever real job before coming to Australia, and I got really burnt out, and, I realized that I wanted to do something more, and moving to Australia, it was meant to be. I was just going to come to do a PhD, and then I was going to go back to Canada, and it really changed my life because funnily enough, my sister and I, because she lives here now as well, we were talking about this the other day because she just married an Australian. You know what our alternative lives would have been like if we had stayed in Canada, and we realized that we're much happier, much more fulfilled, and have much more opportunities, I think. And I think part of what's really great about Western Australia is that there's, you know, I think people kind of joke about, you know, WA stands for wait a while, or that no one does anything here, but there's a lot of opportunities to do new things and to do it differently. And I really felt that living here, and yeah, really, really love living in Australia.
Gorgeous. So obviously the subject of Facebook and privacy is undeniably topical. However, I'm really less interested in decoding that specifically and more interested in discussing internet privacy generally. Now, my reason for that is because right now, at the time of recording this podcast, the government is looking to release the COVID-19 tracking app. And basically, this app will monitor our movements with permission via GPS in order to track those infected with coronavirus and tracing who they've been in contact with. Given your experience and your studies in the area of privacy, what are your thoughts with regards to privacy in the context of an app like this that does have the potential to save lives, but in some ways it's also quite intrusive? Should we trust this kind of app?
Yes, and that's a really great question. And I think a really useful way of understanding the kind of potential risks or implications of this is what privacy researchers and internet researchers call function creep or feature creep, which is basically when you collect data for one usage or private information, for example, and then use it for another. And it's kind of one of the reasons that there's a lot of concerns around what Facebook is doing. I'll give an example. In Canada, there was riots around a hockey game that happened a few years ago, and they wanted to find out who was rioting in the streets. And so they'd actually use CCTV footage to cross-reference driver license photos to find out who actually was rioting. And that's, a good use of it. But you can see how when you go in to have your driver license photo taken, you weren't thinking about would that actually mean that there's going to be a big database of me that makes me findable in case I commit a crime? Mm. And then that, again, that seems like a fine usage of it, but, you know, consider that we have countries, I mean, Donald Trump, right? Would you want to give that to him, that control to, you know, be able to find out people protesting him? I mean, that's an example.
So, yes, he shall not be named.
Yes, yes. So, I mean, or any kind of space where you're a kind of a potentially a dissident, and being a dissident or being an activist, and what and who you're fighting against, that might change very quickly. And I think, you know, we see that already happening with the stuff that's happening in the States. So there's that. And then there's also the issue of hacking. So if we look at historically, there have been situations where governments have collected a whole bunch of data and it's been hacked and used for other things. And so I think people have that attitude, oh, I have nothing to hide. But in terms of thinking about those other potential misuse of your information down the road, I think that might change that answer a bit, because there is, you know, stuff gets hacked all the time. It's very, especially the government does not have a good track record of keeping our data safe. If we also think about the census.
So, Kate, let's get back to curiosity. Another area where you have really mastered the curious is in the world of gaming. Specifically, this has been focused on the making of immersive reality games and escape rooms, converging both the virtual and physical worlds to ignite human transformation. Now, firstly, I think most people listening would have some concept of what a virtual computer game is. However, the fusion between the virtual and physical world is not as common. So can you talk me through how a game that exists in both worlds work? And from there, how do these dual environments ignite human transformation or even human purpose?
Well, that's a great question. So I think the Pokemon Go is a really great example of how you can merge the physical and the real. And so when that game came out, because I'd been making these sort of mixed realities, another way of describing it, games since 2007. So when Pokemon Go came out 10 years later, it was like, finally I could go, it's kind of like Pokemon Go, or it's kind of like escape rooms, and people would understand. And so it's, imagine like, instead of the controller for your screen when you're playing a video game, it's like your body is the controller, and the game board or the game screen is the physical world. But taking it kind of a step further than Pokemon Go is that there's actually often things in the physical world that are part of the game. For example, there might be actors or physical world clues. So it's not just kind of overlaying a digital screen, for example, or augmented reality onto the physical world. It's actually really merging those two things together and merging physical objects with potentially digital things that could happen, such as a chat room or a bot that might call you. So it's really kind of taking that experience to the next level. And how I think that they are kind of tools for helping people to be curious and have different experiences and kind of be transformative spaces is it really draws on this idea that kind of comes from game studies, which is this idea of the magic circle. And it's basically this idea that if you're inside this magic circle, this space, when you're playing games, and I think you can experience this anytime you've played a game, doesn't have to be, a mixed reality or augmented reality game. It can be a board game. It can be any kind of game. And we all play games. And it's that experience of when you're playing a game, it's like the rules change. You are more open to trying new things. You're more open to experimenting. You're simultaneously serious about winning the game, but you're also very playful and okay with potentially failing. And so in taking that to kind of beyond just having a game board in front of you, but to the streets or to a specific purpose, it actually allows the people playing the game, playing it together, playing it around a specific problem. So I've made games around privacy and games around looking at issues of gentrification in neighborhoods. It allows for the kind of that opening up of conversations and possibilities and people trying and experimenting and doing new things that I think that they wouldn't do normally, to be curious about different ways of being and different potential futures and imagining things that they wouldn't have otherwise, or opening up discussion for things that they wouldn't have otherwise.
Yeah, look, I mean, in listening to you ponder this idea, the one thing that comes to mind when I think about the application of purpose is sustainability and how we can potentially use the intersection between a virtual world and the real world to make more sustainable choices or more conscious decisions based on, say, virtual prompts. I mean, have you got any case studies or stories around how this could actually come into play?
Yeah, so there's when the kind of heyday of these games was kind of the late 2000s, early kind of noughties, and there was a game called World Without Oil, which was kind of a similar game in this genre. There's a bunch of different terms for it, like pervasive game or alternate reality game, but it was actually a way of imagining what a world without oil could look like. So it is that exact thing where it is imagining a different potential future. And I think that it's the other thing that I've seen as well is Scott Ludlam, who used to be Green Senator for Western Australia, who I'm sure a lot of people are familiar with his name. He actually did some work in virtual reality that he shared in his TEDx talk at TEDx Perth, I think 2017. And what he was really interested in, what he was experimenting with virtual reality in terms of sustainability was actually being able to visualize and make visible our usages of things. So it would actually show, it was a neighborhood, and it would actually show how much garbage, for example, or rubbish was created by the house, or how much electricity was being used. Because a lot of these things, we don't actually get that visual feedback. So he was using the kind of virtual environment as a way of kind of helping people to really understand the inputs and outputs, the consumption of their house, to rethink the way that they used resources from the planet.
Do you think we will get to a time, for example, where, say, we're, you know, wandering through our apartment and taking the rubbish out or doing day-to-day things where we might have like an app on our phone or something that actually gives us that data in real time, so that we're able to be more conscious with that constant reminder from digital platforms? Do you think that's a possibility?
Yeah, there is actually a platform here in Western Australia that does something similar to that, which helps you to track your usages. I think it's called Simply Carbon, but it does allow it. It is that same idea of just being an app that's a lot more simple, and you don't have to jump into virtual reality, but it actually allows you to start tracking the usages of things that contribute to carbon emissions. So I think we're starting to head in that way, and there is that the move towards what's called the Internet of Things. So that idea of basically everything has a sliver of the internet in it and can keep track of various things, and then plugs into your home, and then you can actually start to keep track of all sorts of different things, like your carbon emissions.
Yeah. So there's definitely like a striking real world application when we're exploring these technologies. And I really do feel that this is quite significant, as I mentioned before, on the backdrop of COVID-19, where the need for virtual worlds that reflect our physical world has really been thrown under the spotlight. And to give that context, just imagine if right now we all had the technology to be, you know, to be having a cup of tea in a virtual cafe for our meeting rather than, you know, sitting on Zoom, as one example. So with that in mind, through the lens of your experience in gaming and in business innovation, how can we use these virtual worlds to enhance our real life interactions?
That's a great question. One of the areas that's been predicted by a number of kind of different experts in the field, that's the change is the new normal that's going to emerge after we've kind of gone through this crisis, is the explosive growth of virtual reality. And virtual reality has been kind of around for a while.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just even thinking about our industry, the speaking industry. Like, we're doing all of these Zoom calls and webinars, but what if we could actually go and sit in a virtual auditorium at a virtual conference and see virtual speakers as if we were at the conference? That would surely take this whole thing to a whole new level.
Yes, and I'm actually, funny you say that, because I'm working with a tech partner here in Western Australia to do just exactly that.
Right.
And we're kind of at the point now where VR has been around for quite a while, and we're kind of in the second wave of it, and we're kind of just reaching just at the point where it is feasible in an accessible way that's not too that's good enough that it's it still has a lot to be developed. It's still like kind of like the early days of social media, the internet, but it's good enough, and the headsets are kind of cheap enough that you can actually do that. So I've been playing around with exactly that virtual auditorium. So it's almost like if you think about virtual reality, it's like the virtual venue hire. And then instead of traveling as a delegate, you actually pay, instead of you have VR travel. So you travel, you don't have to travel on an airplane, you travel through VR. And so, you can actually go and be co-present with the speakers and other delegates. And the benefit of it is that on a Zoom call, you've probably noticed you can't just pull someone aside and have a conversation with them. And there's no, you know, tea break or networking drinks, but you can do that in VR.
Well, you have that real life experience happening around you, right?
Yes, exactly.
And can we do curious crazy together for a minute? Because the biggest question that this poses for me is like, well, what does this mean for human consciousness? Like, who are we? Do you know what I mean? Like, if I actually don't need to leave my office, and I can put on some VR goggles and I can literally go on a plane, I can go to any conference, I can have any immersive experience, pretty much any. I mean, there are some things that will always remain exclusively physical, but mostly I can experience almost any environment. Well, what does that mean for our identity? Like, who are we in all of that?
Yeah, and I think that's a really good question. And I think that's kind of like with any new technology, that's kind of the question I think we start to ask. And if you look at kind of the development of like the internet and yeah, any new technology, we kind of have this existential moment where we say, well, what does this mean? Are we all going to just like when the internet started becoming a thing, there's a lot of rhetoric around, well, what does this mean for humans? And are we all just not going to talk to each other anymore and just like look at our screens? And that kind of did happen, but there's always going to be desire for human connection, unless I think you're a transhumanist and you want to like upload your brain to a computer, which I don't think most people want to do. There's a number of people who want to do that. That doesn't interest me.
That said, I did interview someone for this podcast on season one, a guy called Jamie Skeller, who's also a gaming expert, funnily enough. And he was talking about something that I think Elon Musk said around that if we want to become an interplanetary species, if that is going to be a reality for humankind, it's going to rely exclusively on our ability to upload our brains, our consciousness into new forms of technology.
Yes, and Elon Musk is actually working on that human computer.
Oh, wow, so that's a work in progress. There you go.
Yeah, well, I mean, who knows if it's possible, but there are definitely a lot of influential, well-funded people in Silicon Valley thinking about these things. So, you know, it may sound crazy, but it's actually not in terms of, you know, it's not a bunch of crazy people thinking about it. It's actually some very serious, people working on this problem. But I think the majority of the population, I mean, I think that still is not something that most people would want to do. And if we think about, you know, if we look at the history of how technology has been adopted, it's been very much about, there's that what's called a moral panic, where we get stressed and worried about what's going to happen. And then what happens is somewhere kind of like the things don't change that much. And the new technology gets adopted. Because I think what happens is we forget the technology is powerful, but we forget that culture and economics and society are also very influential, which is why, for example, we predicted that the internet was going to, or there's a lot of people hoping that the internet would overcome inequality, but they forgot about the fact that, you know, society kind of is in the way. Technology can't do it by itself. And it's interesting to look at how all of what's happened with COVID-19 has actually not been because of technology, but because of changes in social norms because of that. And that actually changed things a lot more quickly. So kind of, yeah, to get back to your answer, what does that mean to be human? What does that mean for human connection? It will be a way for people. I think air travel is going to be we're not going to get back to the same level. And we'll be able to use this as a way to connect with each other more potentially overseas. But I still think there's going to be a desire for that human connection. And I think also because hopefully us realizing how much time we've been spending away from each other and on screens, and now we're seeing actually, oh, it's really nice to spend time with our family again now that we're not so busy. I'm hoping that this will be a big reset for people. And that wasn't brought about because of technology. But I think between the two, having the technology and this kind of reset in human connection, I think I'm hoping that we'll be a bit more balanced this time and using technology in a way that's serving us as humans rather than just kind of, we got to this point where it was not serving us. It was causing depression and causing us to be disconnected from each other.
Yeah, which is an interesting segue to my next question, because I think in a conversation about purpose, we sometimes overlook the most practical base level applications of purpose. And I think in a world where we are literally downloading 2.5 quintillion bytes of data per day, we need to be so purposeful about seeking out data and information that is useful. When I say that, I mean that personally as well as professionally, in that, like, if you think about, for example, the news at this point in time with COVID-19, it's literally like a fire hose of bad news and information that's really been designed to hack our attention through, you know, fear, anger and outrage. Hence why we don't, you know, we don't get as much good news. But even for a business, it's so vital to really know how to be purposeful about the data that we bring in so that it has a useful application for us, so that so that we can actually make it meaningful. So what is your advice for getting curious about data and purposeful about the data that we want?
Yes, I think that's really important because I've been hearing a lot of discussions, and there's a lot of science actually behind how if you're fearful, you can't actually think properly. Like your brain actually, like this is, you know, getting out of my area of knowledge, my expertise, because I'm not not a biologist or a neuroscientist, but there is science that shows that basically because of evolution, the way that we're wired to work in fear and a fight or flight response, it just shuts down thinking.
Yeah, well, it releases cortisol. It's like, yeah.
Yes, So I feel like curiosity is actually the opposite of fear. And so if we can approach what's happening now and approaching the news and approaching information with a curious mindset, and I think also that importance of thinking for yourself and thinking critically around where news comes from and how relevant it is and how much you really need to think about it and how much it's impacting you and how much do you actually need to know as a business. So being curious about that, and I think being curious about, you know, what is this? What can I learn from this? Or is there something I need to be curious about? Or is there something that I can spend my time being curious about right now that's actually going to help me down the road? So this is kind of how I've been dealing with this myself. I was feeling very fearful at the beginning of all of this, because you know, you and I are in the same. Work in the same industry, which was, I think, one of the kind of early adopters of being impacted heavily by COVID. So it was very, very stressful. But I just realized that there was a number of people who helped me to get past that and realize that that really wasn't serving me. And I switched to being curious and switched to trying to solve the problems that I was facing and the problems that my friends and clients were facing by being curious rather than being fearful. And I think that applies to the information we're receiving, but even just like solving the problems that we're having. So on a personal level, I'm really into rock climbing and bouldering, and the gyms have been closed for a month and it started making me crazy. So I started researching all of these different things around where can I go outside?
What have you done to your house?
Or how can I build my own climbing wall at home? And then challenging myself to actually do that and getting my friends who are also interested in climbing involved. And so now that's actually created this really great experience for me where I'm learning how to do something new, kind of innovating and solving my problem. And it's really driven by being curious about, instead of going, I'm going to be depressed because I can't go rock climbing, I'm actually going to be curious about what I can do to solve it and actually learn something new from that.
So, Kate, I know you're talking about curiosity in quite a broad fashion at the moment, but you actually do speak about this as being what you call the curious quotient. So with that in mind, can you tell me a little bit about why you think curiosity is a kind of intelligence? And what are the tools, if you were to distill the tools, what are the tools that you would use to unlock curiosity as a way to ignite a more purpose-driven life?
It's a great question. One of the actual physical tools that I love to use is actually a methodology called Lego Serious Play, which was developed by Lego and two European business professors to as an innovation and creativity tool within organizations. And if you've played with Lego before, you kind of have to throw out everything you know about Lego to understand how this works, because you're not actually building things in the physical world. You're not building cars and buildings. You're building things with that are in your mind. You're building metaphors and stories and things that might be in your unconscious mind. And in doing that, you're actually unlocking stuff that might be hidden in your own brain and your team's brain. And I love this as a tool actually for curiosity and the kind of flow on and benefits from it, because it helps people to it helps people to be connected and curious about each other, which I think is one of the really kind of important uses of being curious, is actually being a better listener. And there is actually research that shows that it does help you to be a better listener and a better collaborator. And so you can actually use it as a tool almost for what I would describe as 3D communication. So what I found in working with people is that you can actually use it as a way to help people to be curious about each other and see the benefits of that. But also, it gets people to be able to share what's in their brain without maybe realizing that it was there, with themselves and with other people. And it takes kind of communication to the next level. And it helps people to actually, I think, that experience of seeing that physical almost communication, that 3D communication, helps people to really see the value of that other people can offer. And I've had also people in workshops say that after an hour of communicating or collaborating this way, they actually feel like they understand each other better, even though they may have worked together for many years, or maybe they just met and that's the first time they're doing it. So it's really, really powerful for that aspect of curiosity. But I think there's also other elements around being able to use curiosity as a way to deal with uncertainty and be more confident when you're met with ambiguity or uncertainty, which I think is really, really important in the world, this new normal, the post-normal world, to be okay with ambiguity. And if you can, I guess, try and this is something I've been doing myself, is if you're meeting with, if you're finding yourself being fearful, to try and step back and be curious about what it is that you can learn from the situation, and use it almost as a way to feel more confident about
can we really
ambiguous situations.
Lean into that for a minute, though.
Yes.
And the reason I say that is because what I heard then is the world is uncertain, and in the context of what's happening right now, never before has it been more uncertain. But not just because of COVID-19, we're also looking at the implications of artificial intelligence, of automation, of global warming. Like, there are so many things that are creating this sense of uncertainty. Mm-hmm. And so it's really natural to have an enormous amount of fear, particularly, say, as a business owner right now, navigating this. So what are the actual steps? Like, how do we actually transform fear into curiosity?
I think it's first is being aware that that's happening, because I think that you need to have a conscious shift. And this is, again, the process that I take myself through is being aware that you're being fearful, and take some steps to what it is that you need to do to, if it maybe is go for a walk in a park. That's one of the great things that I love doing.
Almost a mindfulness practice.
Yes. Yep. So spending time in nature, that's a really easy way of doing it, is to go and spend some time in nature. I actually, when all this started, I'd been doing this for a while, but got back into the habit again, is actually going and working from a park for a few hours a day. So just, you know, if we have work that you can do from anywhere with a laptop, take your your laptop to the park and do work there, or just do some phone calls there to spend some time in nature. And there's actually tons of research around that as well out of Japan around the health benefits of being in nature because of the polyphenols that trees give off. And so when I get fearful or stuck, I will go for a walk in the park, even if it's just 15 minutes. And that I find just resets my brain and actually starts my brain thinking about things again and being able to ask questions and be curious and starts to shift my thinking. So that's a great way to do it. You may have a different practice. Find out what works for you. But yeah, nature's the quickest way to do it. I think that's kind of accessible to most people. And then it's shifting into asking those questions and being open to opportunity and asking, well, what if it was this way? Or what can I learn from this? Or what might happen if? Or even just asking other people and having a dialogue with other people and being curious about other people's answers or maybe posing it on the internet. So asking kind of a lot of questions of yourself and other people. And then often you can find the solution to the thing that you're being fearful of. Again, for me, it was being fearful of the fact that I didn't have my regular exercise routine anymore and it was starting to actually make me feel mentally and physically unwell. In doing that, I started asking questions around, well, what can I do to solve this problem? And can I actually build this in my gym? And do other people want to help me? And what would that look like? And started actually asking my climbing community about helping me to build that indoor climbing wall in my garage. And so you can often find, I think, a solution to the thing that is potentially stressing you, or at least get some insight into it so that maybe it's something that's less fearful. Because I think part of the fear is the unknown, not knowing what might happen. And at least this way in being shifting from fear to curiosity and asking questions, you're at least going to get some more information around what the answer to that might be. So if you're feeling fearful about how AI might impact your business, then moving, you know, being curious about what does that look like and who can I ask that's an expert in this, and or what resources are there? What podcast can I listen to? And then that I think can really help you, that whole process to shift into feeling more confident about this new future or ambiguity in general.
So, Kate, we have come to the last question for today. And one of the things I know about you is you're a purveyor of the future. And I mean, we've seen that over the course of your last few answers. But in many ways, I know that you really do sit on the edge of the future in everything that you do. So with that in mind, how do you think COVID-19 has created a sliding door moment that will alter the destiny for the future, whether that be in the future of work or something more broad like the future of the planet?
Oh, I love that. So I think we've had a lot. So up until before COVID, I think there was a lot of discussions around the future of work. And it's like we've shifted into this new future of work, because the way we thought about it before was all of this was going to come about. These huge transformational things were going to come about because of artificial intelligence and VR. And it's kind of like this, the most disruptive thing, most disruptive quote-unquote technology has actually been what we've had to do to protect ourselves from a virus. And what it's done, I think, that is so interesting in terms of thinking about this new future of work and what the new possibilities are, is that it's almost like, you know, that saying, if you don't like how the table is set, then flip the table. Well, the table's been flipped. And so how are we going to put that back together? Are we going to try and do something to go back to the old way? Are we going to try and do something new? Because right now, I think anything, the impossible is possible. And if you think back to World War II, before World War II, there was men's work, and women were not allowed, pretty much socially not allowed to do that. There's all these things that prevented women from being in the workplace. And if you had said to someone, this needs to change, that's just impossible before the war. But after, it hugely shifted what women were seen and allowed to do and potentials and opportunities for women. So I think it's similar to that in that moment of making the impossible now possible. And we see that across the board around things being moved entirely online. What seemed like it would take forever to make that shift has already happened. And so I think we have this other beautiful moment now where we can actually make work for everybody, because right now it doesn't really work for everybody, especially if you're a woman with young children. Women are still responsible for a large majority of the domestic work and child rearing. And so it actually makes it harder for women to fully participate in the way that they want. We talk about women having it all. But, you know, it's probably very stressful to be doing that. And so I think what we're seeing, obviously, we need to have better childcare support, because I think women with young kids at home and families with young kids at home in lockdown are feeling very stressed. But the, I think all, people are also seeing that by not having to commute and being able to do work when you want, when it suits you, rather than a 9-to-5 schedule, is actually opening up a lot of discussions and potentials to recreate work in a way that actually is more human and more diverse, and allowing for it to be something that suits everybody. So what are we going to rebuild? How are we going to rebuild? Is it going to be something different? Or is it going to be something that's going back to the way that it was before? Are we going to actually use this as an opportunity to say, you know what, let's fix a lot of the things around work flexibility and working from home? And that actually solves a lot of other problems as well around pollution and commuting times. And so, yeah, we have this great opportunity to create a new future of work. And also thinking about things like universal basic income, which we've kind of started to do in another way with like stimulus packages for people, for businesses, like the JobKeeper program. What if we actually instituted that? And what could that do in terms of making things be a lot more equitable and encouraging people to maybe do things that they wouldn't get paid for normally, that actually are good for encouraging better support for caring for children, caring for the elderly, things that, that we value but don't actually pay for. If we brought in things like the universal basic income, it would allow for people to do that and still not have to worry about the financial side of things. So it allows us to, I think, reconnect with those things that we're seeing the real value of now, but haven't really, we value but haven't really valued because we haven't put the money and resources into it. So I think there's a really great potential here for a reset, for a really positive new future. We're starting to see the glimmers of.
The imaginings are becoming possible, or more possible anyway.
Yes.
And what a lovely spot to end the podcast today. Thank you so much for joining me on the Decoding Purpose podcast. As always, it's been a truly thought-provoking and inspiring conversation. I've loved having you on, Kate.
Thanks. It's been great to be here.
Where can we visit you via your digital homes?
Love that, digital homes. KateRainsGoldie.com is the easiest way to find me.
Fantastic. Well, we look forward to chatting with you again at some point on the edge of the future. Thanks for joining me on Decoding Purpose. Thanks for joining us on the podcast. If you have enjoyed the podcast, please take a moment to leave us a review. That would be greatly appreciated. And we'd also love you to join the Purpose Movement at Instagram by following us at Decoding Purpose Podcast. Also, a big shout out to our sponsors at Supernova Sound.